Okay, well, neither rain nor sleet nor snow. So thanks everybody for coming I think it will be a very interesting conversation about leveraging technology innovation to solve development challenges. I think we're meeting at a very interesting time here in Washington as we have a number of interesting phenomena, including at USAID in terms of making significant investments in science and technology, along with major change in innovation in the private sector, and also the way that the private sector is thinking about solving social problems. So I think we're meeting at a very interesting time. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Dan Rundy. I run something called the Project on Prosperity and Development, and it's really my pleasure to have two very distinguished guests with me here today. I want to first welcome Gabby Zettelmeyer, who's the Vice President of Office of Social Innovation for Hewlett-Packard, and then my friend and colleague Alex Deegan, who's the Science and Technology Advisor to the Administrator of USAID, and who I believe is one of the most distinguished public servants at AID, and I really do mean that. So it's a real privilege to have you, Alex. So let me just start with a couple questions, because I think it'd be more interesting to hear from our guests than to hear too much more from me about this. But I think that Alex, you've set up this new Office of Science and Technology. AID has historically had a science and technology component and sort of went away from it and has now come back. Can you tell us a little bit about the thinking behind that and tell us a little bit about some of the initiatives that you're doing in the office?
Gladly, and thank you all for coming out on such a rainy day. So our strategy is based around a few key principles. The first is that development is technical. It has a strong technical component. Science, technology, engineering, and innovation are necessary components of what we're trying to do. Many problems in development can be characterized through science and technology. We can find solutions through science and technology. And according to some studies, you know, a significant percentage of economic growth, some people claim up to 80%, comes through advances in science and technology and innovation. Just as we have used science to create the last green revolution, we must create the next one. And, you know, we have to think about, in many places in the world, we haven't really changed the indicators on the ground for 50 years. So how can we do things differently? How do we move from gradualistic growth to sort of revolutionary growth in terms of the advances that we can make? And that means taking some risks. And the second component is the nature of the threats that we face are increasingly transboundary. They require solutions that cross political boundaries, that cross geological boundaries, that cross boundaries across the country and across the world that require us to actually tap into expertise everywhere, and that requires us to also build science and technology capacity in other parts of the world. Because quite frankly, these problems are big enough that they're beyond the scope of any single agency to solve, perhaps beyond the scope of any single country to solve, and we really have to empower people around the world to be able to solve those problems with us, to be able to help us reduce costs even in our own country about around healthcare, if we can make advances in frugal innovations for healthcare abroad. Third and related is the idea that talent and creativity are everywhere, and we have to unleash that. Bill Joy, one of the co-founders of Sun Microsystems, said, no matter who you are, the smartest people always work for someone else. And so this idea is, how do you actually capture this? And, you know, before the internet, it didn't matter that there were some exceptionally smart people in Dakar. It was really hard to capture that. But now with gains in communication and internet technologies, we have the ability to really make use of all of this. But how do we do it? Well, we don't do it how we've done development in the past, which is a group of, you know, what perhaps used to be white men sitting in a room that would dictate what are the solutions, what are the problems, and here's a five-year plan. And I don't think we do that anymore. I don't think that works. I think you use tools like open innovation. You really define the problems. You define the critical constraints. You use things like crowdsourcing as a way to look to unleash creativity around the world. And in this way, you know, you move from a handful of development agencies to 7 billion development agents around the world. And that is tied hand in hand with empowering people through science and technology. The last bit is connecting the unconnected. And I think we're in a dangerous situation where you have, we talk about the wealth discrepancies that are in the United States between the rich and the poor, but there is an information discrepancy, which is a few billion people around the world have access to a few hundred centuries of information. And the amount of knowledge that is at our fingertips in this room is unprecedented. The fact that we can pull up this information on a smartphone or another mobile platform, and mobiles means anything portable that you can convey and bring information to, is unprecedented, right? But what about those people who are not connected? What does that mean? It means that there's an accelerating gulf between them and us. But if we can take that challenge and turn it into an opportunity by trying to connect the unconnected, we can provide them information and knowledge that's useful for healthcare, that's useful to help leapfrog banking systems, to help them actually get access to information about agriculture, to help them get information on how to use water smarter, to give them education opportunities in places where are in far distant rural communities, and we can close that gap. And I think those four principles are fundamentally what we are looking at when we're thinking about our science and technology strategy at AID. If I can just briefly talk about what we're doing, it's focused on a couple of key areas, first of which is launching a series of grand challenges for development. We launched our first one, Saving Lives at Birth, last March. And what was incredible about it was ensuring all women from the onset of labor to 48 hours after delivery have access to medical care, whether they're in a hospital or a hut. So making that point of where they are located irrelevant, and specifically looking at three critical constraints. So service delivery being one of them. Second is demand generation among the mothers themselves in terms of being able to seek access to knowledge. And the third are tools of science and technology that we could use to help bridge that gap between them. What was interesting about this was a couple of things. First is it was this problem statement without dictating a particular solution, as we were saying. Second was it was done in partnership. And we did this in partnership with the Norwegian government, the Gates Foundation, the World Bank, and Grand Challenges Canada. And it is this idea that these problems are so big, we should be looking to leverage partners. And what was great was we had, unlike a typical aid RFP where you have maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 20 proposals, we had 612 proposals, half from overseas, a quarter from the developing world. We brought 77 of those finalists together within a development exchange at USAID that actually took some inspiration from the development marketplace at the World Bank, but also a science fair we had at the UN General Assembly meetings last year in New York, where we brought together people working on design for the other 90% and brought the technologies they had developed. The 77, we spent a few days actually focused on how do you actually incubate their skills? How do we actually encourage all 77 people to be successful, even though only 25 of them would be receiving grants to scale up what they were trying to do? And we invited other donors to come and see their ideas. But one of the great things was to see how they started collaborating with each other and the power of that. We're looking at other grand challenges on education, on energy, perhaps on transparency and corruption, which I think would be a fair tax on economies in the developing world to take on, and I think the use of mobiles is able to do that. Second has been thinking about how do we leverage other federal science agencies? And one of our, we spend billions of dollars in this country on science and technology. How do we transfer that knowledge that is already paid for by taxpayers to the developing world? How do we create partnerships? And one of our signature programs underneath this has been PEER. It is a partnership with the National Science Foundation, where NSF, which funds $100 million in the developing world, is unable to fund the developing country counterparts, unable to fund their students, unable to fund their labs, unable to fund their researchers. So we've stepped up through the National Academy of Sciences to start doing that. And fundamentally, to create research programs that actually unite scientists in the United States with those in the developing world and be able to level the playing field. And that's the idea behind PEER, is not only are we making use of the scientific peer review process at NSF, but we're trying to actually create an opportunity that our counterparts in the developing world really are peers for American scientists. Third, just very briefly, geospatial technologies. It's USAID is a $20 billion, depending on what our final budget looks like, $24 billion, hopefully more some days, place-based organization that requires a systems approach to development problems. That lends itself well to the use of GIS, because what you want to do when you're placing an HIV clinic or you're placing a TB clinic or you're trying to decide where a well goes is look at where other donors have their wells. Look at what the needs are. Look at what the geology are. Look at disease prevalence across a region. And then ultimately being able to have tools that allow for crowdsource information to come into that platform to allow us to populate this. And this, again, is a way to leverage other federal science agencies. We just signed an MOU with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, millions of dollars of satellite imagery that we want to make available at AID to be able to do better development, to make better decisions. That actually led us to one other problem. We realized our data systems really tracked how much we spend, but not what we do and where we do it. And that's a real serious problem if you're going to do development well. So in conjunction with our CIO's office, working with Sean Carroll, the head of our essential management head at USAID, working with Susan Reichle, the head of the policy bureau, we are now working to try to take on this fundamental problem. The last thing is just building up scientific expertise back into the agency, and this is a couple of different ways, making universities part and parcel of who we are and how we do things as opposed to looking at us as a piggy bank. And we're trying to develop relationships with places like MIT and the Blum Center at Berkeley, which really do things in very novel ways. Second has been just bringing in new scientists into the agency in large numbers. And 2 years in a row, we've been able to double the number of AAAS fellows, bring in tenured university professors, and now looking at senior technical career tracks so people can have an option to maintain their skills.
Thanks, Alex. Gabby, I get the sense that Hewlett-Packard probably also doesn't like being looked upon as a piggy bank. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how Hewlett-Packard's evolved its thinking about solving societal problems. We were talking in the green room before about that you didn't want to just be approached to just write a check. You bring people, technology, networks to challenges. Tell us a little bit about that. Mm.
I think this specific piece here about HP is that it was founded over 70 years ago, and at the time, both Hewlett and Packard were pioneers. They were so forward thinking in creating a company that operates at the intersection of creating shareholder value, which we know is very important, but at the same time creating social value. That seems to be a novel concept that now gets written up in Harvard Business Review and everywhere else. But they said 70 years ago, let's take a step back and think why a company exists. And it is, of course, to drive and maximize profits, but it's to create a value for society. And so let's take a look at how we achieve what we want to achieve. And I think this is this whole notion of global citizenship, which has been a corporate objective for HP for over 50 years. So it didn't come as a compliance issue. It didn't come as risk mitigation. It came as a way to do business. So this is why I think it's also so important to see how this is connected to the business strategy. I run the Office of Social Innovation. And what we have done in order to determine how we should contribute and provide social good is we looked, first of all, at all of the social issues out there. But then we looked at our portfolio and said, how can that best match and where can we make the biggest difference? But we also said, where are some of the markets where we want to grow, whether it's geographically or whether this is vertically? So looking at that, we said clearly the health market is a market where we really want to grow dramatically. You know, all of us know that, you know, we travel around the world and we use our ATM cards and we can put them into a machine in Ouagadougou and we will get money. But you move from east part of Washington to the western part of Washington, then you got to go to your doctor's office and copy your files and take them to the doctor if you want to change, you know, the treatment or the hospital or the office. So we're so far behind. It's a tremendous opportunity for HP. But what we wanted to do there then is build out in the social space reference cases so that ministries of health and those decision makers in health can see what it is that HP can bring to the table. So very important too, and I'll give you some examples later on, how you really say that this is a reference case, it's opening doors, it's creating relationships, and it's enabling us to sit at the table when in the future RFPs will be issued and business will be given away, for us to show we do everything from, you know, the mobility aspect, the front end, the laptop, the server, the network, the storage, the software that glues it together. We have over 200,000 services people. It's not really that well known. But once you build these cases and you show what you can do by addressing some of the biggest issues in health, all of a sudden people know. Just one example of how we did that. We went into Africa to say, so where are some of these big issues that we want to address? And we went in with the Clinton Health Access Initiative and started in Kenya, where we said one of the big issues that we see in the entire continent is that when children get born, it usually within the first 4 to 5 weeks, their blood gets taken to determine whether they are HIV infected or not. And so everything is a manual process. You know, blood gets taken, things get written down into an envelope, off to the national lab, taken out, manual. Stuff gets lost. By the time it gets put back into an envelope and couriered sometime into the rural areas, oftentimes 4 to 5 months have passed. So now you have the issue that it's too late for the child to receive that treatment. So we sent in some of our IT engineers, our design architects, and they did what they would do for every major customer. They did an IT transformation of that issue, of that system. And we built 5 data centers in the country. One is in the Ministry of Health, 2 are in the national labs, and 2 are in remote areas. And now, once the blood is analyzed, it takes a day or two to be sent back to those areas where there is internet. Where there is no internet, we went back to our imaging and printing group to say, we need a GSM-enabled printer so that we can SMS the results, because culturally, it's so important for the mother to get the results into her hands and to see, here is the fact, here is what we need to do. Now, talk about reference case. All of a sudden, the Ministry of Health sees they have these services architectures, they can do a whole transformation, they have the mobility aspect, they can do the cloud mobility solution, they do the analytics, they've got the software to glue it together. And now the Kenyan country manager comes to me and says, you know, it's nice, I've been invited for bidding opportunities that I hadn't been invited to. So it's matching that, driving the business, driving up your reputation and getting our employees, you know, a lot of these employees went in to do the assessment to share their skills. I think that makes all the difference in the world.
Gabby, tell us about this example of partnering with UNHCR, because we were talking about this, about how do you bring your people to problems? We were talking earlier about a number of companies have expertise, technology expertise, scientific expertise, or solving problems that ties to what Alex was talking about. Like, we need to think differently and solve problems differently. And this HIV example you just gave certainly is, because that is an atrocious example. 4 or 5 months, it's ridiculous. So tell us a little bit about the UNHCR example, because I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah. So what we want to do at HP is get our employees, we have over 320,000 of them, to share their skills. So although it's great if they go and help in the soup kitchen and paint walls, you know, and if they want to do that, fine. But what I'm trying to do is get them to share their skills. And some of them have come to me and said, you know, I'm a supply chain manager. I don't know about your health programs. I know nothing about health. So can I be of help? And I said, of course. The NGOs that we work with, they are pretty good in health themselves. They don't need medical assistance, but they need to make sure the syringes are where they need to be at the same time. And our supply chain is over $65 billion worth, so we know how to manage that. I need you guys to help those NGOs to straighten their processes. So what we've done is we've started to see how we engage with institutions where our employees can become either coaches, mentors, or how they find platforms to share their skills and develop them at the same time. The first thing that we've did last year is engage with the Global Health Corps, and you know, that send fellows into Africa and match up one fellow from an African country, and then usually it's a fellow from one of the fine institutions in the US where these guys have just graduated. So it's usually a pair of 2 people, young guys just out of university, that address health issues in 5 African countries. And so we put our employees sort of next to them. And it was a virtual thing, so they didn't travel to Africa. Our employees would sit in Palo Alto or in Japan or in Germany, and they would have regular contact with these two folks. And every time these two folks ran into an issue to say, there is something I need to figure out on the finance process, I don't know how to do it, our guys would tap into the HP system and find the finance guys that would help them solve the problem. So this way, not only did we address some of these problems, but our guys got to understand what it means to be in Rwanda on the ground to solve these problems. So we thought that was a great start, and then we wanted to build that out. And I just had a meeting yesterday with Antonio Guterres, who's heading up the UNHCR, to say what we've done now is extended this high potential program where we tap into our best and brightest employees to work with the refugee camps, to go in and not only share some of the technology to make sure that people start getting connected, but to start sharing skills, to build out entrepreneurship skills, and to really basically do a capacity building exercise together with starting in selected camps and then building that out and getting more and more employees engaged. And what we see is that every employee, if we do a little bit of awareness, and we do a lot of metrics, at HP everything gets measured, so we do a lot of correlations, and we saw that when the perception of our employees about our social impact work goes up by a single point, they're twice as likely to stay with the company. And even if you subtract or add or whatever, say there is an error of margin, it tells you how important it is and how much it sets you apart as an employer when your employees see that you care, that you really use your technology, your skills, and come up with really some forward-looking programs where they can engage and share their skills. Because then I think we have a chance to address the issues of the world. More than half of the largest, if you look at the 100 largest economies in the world, more than half of them are companies. They're not countries, they're companies. And then think that companies have a responsibility, but it's not just the company, it's the people in the company to share their skill. And maybe it's not only in the emerging markets, maybe you just have to look into your own backyard and take a look at migrant kids that, even if you just spend time with one that you get through school and help find a job with the connections that you have done a small miracle.
Now, talk a little bit about entrepreneurship. This is another area of importance for Hewlett Packard, and you've got a number of initiatives there. Tell us a little about that.
One of the biggest issues that we've identified again in the world is that there are so many young graduates coming out of school that cannot find a job. It's a big problem here in the US, it's a big problem in Europe, it's a huge problem in a lot of the growth or emerging markets, huge. So we've put together a curriculum that uses IT. So it's not that you learn IT and then you learn how to do a business plan, it's everything is IT based. So folks will learn how to use IT to do a business plan that then helps them get more funding, to do an accounting plan, to do a marketing plan, how to set up a state-of-the-art website, how to do collateral that you can afford, how to get your name out, how to make sure you also know about privacy, security, all of these basic things that a young entrepreneur would have to know. And then hopefully work with some of the NGOs to actually support them in setting up their own entrepreneurships. We have the program in over 47 countries, in over 20 languages, over 300 training centers. And what we're doing right now, because this was very much a project where we taught, we have great teachers that teach that program, and some people will succeed, and a lot of people will go through the program that will not succeed, and maybe they didn't even have enough interest to succeed. It's hard to always make the right selection. So what we want to do now is take the entire curriculum, make it online available, so in sort of serious gaming format, and get people to take this online curriculum first, and those that stick with the program, do the modules, and where you see there's an interest and people are really also going through the program, then sort of filter it through and make an advanced curriculum with these teachers available for them, because we found that we've put thousands of people into jobs already, and I think we could multiply that and really scale it phenomenally. And we're working with organizations like AID and others around the world to really use all kinds of different channels to get this training to people and make it available.
So perhaps this is a future grand challenge, is how do we employ all the young people that are going to be coming out of schools in a variety of parts of the world. You also looked at education, Alex. Could you talk a little bit about how you approach the education issue? Touched a little bit upon it in terms of bringing in university professors and tripling the AAAS fellows, but you've also thought about science education more generally.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that there's one, you know, we're faced with just in North Africa 100 million new jobs needed to be created there. So if we're looking at stability in a region that's going to be hit by factors like climate change that is already in the midst of strife, thinking new ways to empower people to be able to be entrepreneurs has to be a focus of development. And I think you've brought up an amazing point, which is if you look at the biggest economies of the world, it is the private sector that has a role. We need to be thinking about the private sector and how do we bring true social entrepreneurship, which I mean, you know, making a profit and having value-driven approaches to what you're trying to do. I think that term has been loosened in how people are thinking about it to be successful. You know, Nike is an example of an organization that makes 50% of footwear manufacturing in Asia. If we can get Nike to make their factories 20% more efficient, we can do a lot in terms of energy use and climate change in Asia that doesn't require, you know, U.S. government investments, so to speak. I mean, it is through those supply chains that you speak of, it is through the individual actions of the employees that you speak of, I think that there's just an incredibly powerful effect. On education, I mean, there's two ways to think about it. You know, we're thinking about a grand challenge on education that ensures literacy for all children. And all children is really important because it gets at the gender gap. You know, you look at Afghanistan, you know, I spent some time there, and it was 34% literacy among men and something like 11% literacy among women. It's gotten slightly better since that time. We've put a lot of people into schools. But if that's what you're starting from, where 50% of your population is 90% illiterate, it is really hard to do anything on development and see the kinds of gains that you have. So we have to connect people. We have to find ways of doing that. And we want to be able to use mobile platforms, all types of mobile platforms and ICT technologies to be able to give people essentially what they are craving, which is access to knowledge and access to information. We created something in Iraq. It's one of my favorite examples. The Virtual Science Library in Iraq was created at a time with a group of former AAAS fellows, American Association for Advancement of Science fellows, that essentially gave 100% of Iraqi students access to the same top-tier science library that you would have if you went to MIT or a major university, all full-text journal access. Everyone told us it wouldn't work, which was really amazing because of electricity and because of internet. Those things weren't there. But what is amazing now is there are 18,000 active users of the system. If you don't use it, you're kicked off. There's been over 1 million journal articles downloaded. We were able to do this on an open source platform and at 95% discount to the publishers gave to the Iraqis. And now the Iraqis pay for the system and own the system and, you know, are actively using the system. So there is, you know, despite our beliefs sometimes, there is actually a craving for knowledge. I mean, the other way is data. And we're sort of at this point where, you know, we can think about how do we use data to really improve educational systems, to understand what are the fallacies in our educational systems. How do we do that in the developing world? And I think that's another important constraint that is out there. In terms of universities, I think for us, it is, you know, right now, I had the opportunity to talk to Dean Shankar Sastry, who's the Dean of Engineering at Berkeley. You know, really brilliant guy, works with the Blum Center for Developing Economies at Berkeley. And for a guy at Berkeley, he told me something I found amazing, which is in 30 years, he's never seen the students more idealistic. And this is at Berkeley. Right, you know. So we're, you know, you're thinking, all right, berserkly. All right, maybe. That's an amazing statement. But you know, my colleague Dave Ferguson, who's joined us today, and I went out to Stanford, to Berkeley, to Santa Clara, to a number of these universities, and we saw exactly that, which were new models of development where students are working across disciplines. You know, you have engineers working with entrepreneurs, working with anthropologists, working with physicians. to develop new true social entrepreneurship companies to try to address these problems, you know, in many ways. And what's interesting is they're not coming to aid, which fundamentally for me suggests we need to think about development differently. We need new models of development that are successful. Mm-hmm. And because the old system, I don't think will survive. I mean, I just don't see that as surviving. So how do we actually not only support what's going on in these university communities, how do we incentivize university communities to move in this direction?
I just want to come back to this issue of data. We were having a conversation by conference call a couple of weeks ago, and you told a story, Gabby, about how you're looking at fake drugs in Africa. Could you talk a little bit about this? Because I think this is about this point about data that Alex was talking about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I called our team 2 years ago social innovation because I really wanted to make sure we take some of the innovations out of the labs and the businesses and apply them to the social space. And we had a lot of resource put into stopping the counterfeiting of our own products in the supply chain. And so a lot of mass serialization, authentication, security processes had done a lot of investment there. And so we worked with a small NGO out of Nigeria and our labs guys on adjusting that solution to make it work for the social space, in this case, for drugs, and to make sure that, you know, we could detect those that have been counterfeit. So the solution is really that when a patient, we started in Nigeria because the infection rate of malaria is so high, 110 million out of 158 are malaria infected. And if you think about it, you go to a pharmacy here and you buy medication, you don't think twice about, could this be useless or could this kill me because it's toxic? But there, chances are, you know, 40% that, you know, this thing could kill you. And so together with Empedigree, we've developed a solution that is a code that is printed on the package of the medicine. And they just scratch it off and SMS it to a free number. Now, 85% of the population has access to a basic mobile phone. This is not smart technology. This is a basic mobile phone. And within 5 seconds, they will get an answer back whether this has been tampered with or whether it's genuine medicine. Now, just think about it. It's the information and the analysis sits in the cloud. It's a basic mobile front end. And it's a beautiful solution that you could take around the world. But to your earlier point, Alex, the ecosystem has to come together to make it work. We are part of it. You know, we're just one part of it. There is an NGO that's part of it. The Ministry of Health is part of it. The telco companies are part of it. The pharmaceuticals are part of it. And we are part of it. So this worked because we came together as a team and we deployed it. Now we've deployed it in India. And that's why I think these alliances that bring the different stakeholders together are so, so important. And, you know, we're part of the mHealth Alliance, for example, where people and organizations come together to take a look at these bigger approaches. And it's so important that we do that as a team and that we really see which role has to be played. And when we talk about this triangulation, you know, about in these public-private partnerships, it's not just one company, it's many companies, it's different NGOs, and it's different parts of the government that need to come together. So it's a pretty big group that needs to do effective work. And when you do that, again, you know, in this case, not only have we now commercialized part of the solution and deploying it in other parts of the world, but we've been invited by the State Department to sit on the task force, you know, anti-counterfeit task force. That lifts your reputation, that gets your name out, that shows your expertise, that puts you as a thought leader in the space and shows how you use innovative technologies to address some of these big issues.
So let me ask you a loaded question. Alliances and partnerships are certainly very important to solve these problems. I think Alex has talked about that, you've talked about this. What would you like to see governments, whether they're local governments or the donor governments, what kinds of change would you like to see happen, or why is it so hard to do this from your perspective?
I think even within governments, we often see that there are so many parts that are not connected, are not talking to each other, and don't really know. The left hand doesn't know what the right is doing. And so, in a way, by getting better connection and better communication means out there, I think that's already a good step in the right direction. And I think we have reached sort of an inflection point where it's enough talk. And I see that really people want to come to the plate. and do something. And you know, as we now drive these alliances, we have to be very tangible very soon to show, and this is the difference that we have made. But I see in general there is a lot of interest from governments and NGOs, and I think the sense of urgency also has gone up.
Yeah.
That's also always something, if I'm really honest, in the beginning when we started the work, we worked to a different timetable than some NGOs were and also some of the governments were, because it took a long time to get through this process and this process and this process, whereas you know, in industry, you know, you're driven by day. It's not even, you know, people say you're quarterly oriented, but you know, it's a daily thing, you know, just get moving. And I see the sense of urgency there, and you know, that can never be enough probably. So we could, you know, as we work on that, I think we're gonna make some really good progress.
Alex, how are you working with the private sector? You've certainly referenced ways in which companies are making change through science and technology. How are you working with the private sector to achieve what you're hoping to achieve? And what would you like to see different in how you're interacting with the private sector?
First, I'd like to give a shout out to Mauro O'Neill, who's our counselor for innovation at USAID and is actually head of our partnerships office, which you helped start, actually. And she has been fundamentally trying to, as an entrepreneur herself, to lead this effort forward, and that is something I think that's very welcome. We've obviously used it within thinking about, for instance, new models. If we're going to do these grand challenges, how can we get private sector partners that are out there? But I think on the flip side is, how do we actually support private sector companies to succeed in terms of being able to scale up solutions? And one of the really innovative programs that I have to give credit to actually my colleague Dave Ferguson for is this partnership with NASA, the State Department, and Nike called Launch. And what it is an incubator program that seeks out within specific different types of fields, health, water, energy is sort of the next one that we're hoping to do. And it was actually based around the space shuttle launches at the Kennedy Space Centers. We bring together 10 of some of the top most promising individuals that are looking to scale up new technologies to try to address these problems. And then we bring together people from government, people from the VC community, people who are technical experts within the fields, and spend 3 very intensive days working with these innovators to help them get what they need to actually scale this up. And then 6 months of follow-up where they're working with, trying to connect them with resources that will allow them to be successful without aid necessarily funding them. And I think that's actually really interesting to see that sort of approach, which is, you know, very different approach than I think that we've been looking for. Can we do a lot more with the private sector? I really would like to. Mm-hmm. You know, fundamentally, it would be great to do more with we are doing partnerships with HP, and it would be great to do many more of them.
Yep.
Watch this space, I think, is I think that one of the takeaways from this conversation. I think it would be appropriate to open up the conversation to the audience. There's some very informed people in the audience. So let's see, I think we've got some microphones here. So people can raise their hand. I'll call on folks. If you can just say your name, your organization, and ask the question in the form of a brief question. So gentleman up here and then the woman back there.
Good afternoon. Thank you for very good information. I'm with Mobilize for Haiti. I'm the chairman. My name is Dominique Toussaint. I am working on a project in Haiti to build a 911 system in the country. One did not exist prior to the earthquake. It still is one of those needs that we really have in terms of managing public safety issues. And as you can imagine, there are a whole host of obstacles that we are facing. I want to kind of talk about what Mr. Diggin
kind of touched on. Question, right?
Sure. How is it that a company like HP could contribute to countries that are not even considered developing to bring technology to address problems kind of like what I've just touched on? And for Mr. Diggin, you also mentioned that the students at Berkeley were not necessarily considering aid. Could it have to do with the perception that they have of what they would have to go through, to be able to work with you.
Fair enough. Thank you very much. Let's see if we can capture the question from the woman in the back, and we'll take them as a bunch.
Okay. Hi. It's actually a very different type of question, yeah. And sort of an overarching one. And it really has to do with how do you create an environment that is, from a policy regulatory environment, conducive to public-private partnerships or engaging with the private sector. And one of the areas that I work in, I'm from the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, have been working now in the food sector for some period of time. And it's one of the biggest issues that we face is that there is incredible resistance, actually, to working on, sort of public sector outcome sorts of things and engaging with the private sector. And I'm wondering if you can comment, or if our panelists can comment on some of the things that they've done to address that.
Yeah, I'll comment on that.
Great, thank you so much.
Happy to do that. Why don't we take the gentleman's questions first, and maybe I think the three of us might speak to that one.
So just like in every other country, the first thing that we do and what's really, really important is to go and find very strong partners on the ground that have a lot of the expertise. We'd never do anything on our own. As far as Haiti is concerned, of course, not only did we do the immediate help when the earthquake struck, but the important thing is to then take a look at how you build capacity over time. So we're working right now with Paul Farmer on the digital hospital to make sure that it has the technology that it needs, and it should become a state-of-the-art hospital that I think a lot of mature markets will take a look at this and will say, I wish we had the same thing. So we're definitely investing, and it's based on the type of partnerships that we're driving.
Alex, do you think people are staying away because it's a lot of paperwork?
Yeah, I think it's way too much paperwork, personally speaking. But the we're at an inflection point in the agency where 95% of our senior leadership can retire today with full benefits. And 60% of the agency has less than 4 years of experience. That is both a challenge and an opportunity for us to take advantage of. And it could be a really important shift in the thinking in the agency that could be positive if we take advantage of it in the right way. We had, through the Development Leadership Initiative, we've brought on a large number of people into the agency. The key is, how do we actually empower them, their ideas, their perspectives, which are very different in some ways than how the agency has done work before, to actually take on some of these major development issues?
Let me take a crack at the woman's question in the back, and then I would welcome comments from both of you about this. Why is this so hard? What's the policy environment, what it needs to be fixed? I'd say a couple things. We're going to be coming out with a report November the 1st, so watch this space as well on taking a look at the partnership how do we take better advantage from a government perspective of the opportunities to work with the private sector and others? I mean, I think public-private partnerships is now a politically correct term. If you're a leader of the World Bank or the head of an agency like AID or UNDP, you at least have to be talking about it. Now, how that talk translates into action is a whole other conversation. I think some of it is some of the stuff that Andrew Natsios has talked about. If you've seen his paper on the counter-bureaucracy, if you just Google on Natsios and the counter-bureaucracy, it's a long paper, so if you have trouble sleeping at night, and Andrew's a friend of mine, but it's actually been sort of a bestseller in the World Bank system and other folks. The Natsios counter-bureaucracy problem, I think, is one of the problems is that the biggest rule book, I think AID and other donors were set up a long time ago where they were the biggest wallet and had sort of a relatively medium-sized rule book. I think over time they've become a smaller and smaller wallet, and they have a bigger and bigger rule book. So that's the point about this counter-bureaucracy thing. There have been all sorts of historical reasons or problems, or people are terrified about having money go down a rat hole and other things that have make it very, very hard and put all sorts of accountabilities around how we spend the public dollars. I certainly understand that. I can't go home to my parents who aren't in the development biz and explain to them, well, hey, there's a little bit of leakage here, and so it's just the cost of doing business, and I'm sure you understand, Mom and Dad. Well, they for some reason don't think that's a good answer. So I do think we have a political or a broader problem around sort of the regulatory environment. We have to balance accountability with flexibility and innovation. So I think so. One part of the problem is how do we allow for innovators like Alex to be able to do interesting things? And so some of it's going to be around unpleasant or unglamorous things like procurement and flex, making it easier for people like Alex to talk to you and do it in a way where you don't send like a 500-page paper in triplicate, you know, to so that you can actually have a structured conversation without people getting freaked out about, oh, well, this is procurement sensitive, et cetera. So I think a big part of it's going to be around plumbing issues. I also think, though, there is a need for ongoing still culture change. I think the development community talks about working with the private sector, but I'd be interested what Gabby thinks about this. I think they talk about working with the private sector, and there's a subset of very switched on NGOs. There's some in the room, for instance, CARE, who I think have made an intellectual journey over 5 or 10 years, where I think if we'd had a conversation like this 10 years ago, I think that we'd have had a different kind of a conversation. We'd have said, hey, try this on, partnerships, it's not such a bad thing. I don't think we're far beyond that conversation when I was doing this 10 years ago. It's now, like I said, it's politically correct to want to work, but it's actually really, when you sort of double click on it, it's actually really hard to do this stuff. It's still, there's plumbing problems, procurement problems, but I'd also say there's still cultural problems where folks in the system, I think some of it, as we hire new people and you get a new generation of folks, I think you get sort of additional thinking. And that's not a crack on my friends and colleagues at AID who've been there a long time. I just think you bring in different perspectives and new ideas over time and a new generation of thinking. So there's a systems problem. I think there's also a culture problem that we need to look at. But I also think we need to think about new instruments as well. I think that chicken or beef, in terms of what we've got, in terms of grants or cooperative agreements mm-hmm. or contracts, may not be the only answer. I think one way we get at that, and it's related to procurement and things like the prize authority that Alex has, and maybe Alex, you could, as part of your answer, just talk about prize authority and crowdsourcing just a little bit, because I think that'll be interesting for this group. And then maybe, Gabby, I'd be very interested in your experience. Certainly, when you go talk to people at the UN system, they say, oh, yes, I want to partner with you. But then when you actually get under the hood, and once you get past the first date, what's it like on the second date over dinner in a movie? Tell us a little bit about what that's like. So maybe so Alex, why don't you start, and then Gabby.
Well, it's really interesting. When you talk about the fear of money going down a rat hole, the one thing that I think of is, we have spent, not just our agency, but lots of other development agencies, a lot of money in a lot of places and haven't seen the successes that we want. Yeah. That, to me, is money down a rat hole.
Yeah, that's the other, exactly. Right. That's about the aid effectiveness rat hole.
Right. Let me just set it straight. S&T is actually part of a larger reform agenda, which includes procurement reform, which Lisa Gomer, our general counsel in the agency, is leading, which includes HR, which includes, you know, budget and focus and selectivity and policy reforms and monitoring and evaluation, critical, and innovation, critical pieces to what we're trying to do. The prizes are interesting because the one great thing about a prize is you only pay for
Explain what we mean by that.
So if you want to set up a competition within AID, and this is what the prize authority is a new mechanism of, and it applies to the entire U.S. government. It came through the America Competes Act that was passed during the lame duck session that was very productive. But the idea is setting out a prize for people to compete without, again, dictating an individual solution. What is great about the prize is you have, you know, you have delineated what it takes to achieve this prize. So you only pay for success, right? You can't say that about a lot of our grants necessarily. You can't. You don't have a situation where you're paying for success up front. And there are similar ideas with advanced market commitments and other sorts of approaches to how we can do development. And what is great about prizes is you generally get people that are a number of degrees of separation from the field that traditionally apply to aid or apply to what you're trying to do. NASA has been a great innovator on this, but people have been using prizes for a long time.
Charles Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic on
the Orteg Prize, which was interesting because it helped lead to the development of the commercial airplane industry. You know, the Ansari X Prize actually helped lead some of the thinking. A $10 million prize, people spend $100 million for, you know, the first person to take three people up into space within, I think it's a week, to 100 kilometers, you know, in two trips, won the prize. It was a $10 million prize. People spent $100 million trying to solve the prize. But we saw a shift to the development of a private spacecraft industry. And you can think of something similar along that lines, you know, is, you know, the first person to get 100 million houses or 10 million houses illuminated in Africa. Well, if you get 20 companies trying to achieve that goal, even though you're rewarding one of those companies, you actually increase the amount of individuals that could be involved. And thinking about how we use it, the one limitation on prize authority passed by Congress is we can't give the prize to non-Americans. And obviously for the Agency for International Development, that kind of undercuts our
barrier,
goals.
Kind of a barrier, yeah. It would sort of a speed bump.
Yeah.
So I think version 2.0 is, so as you're talking to members of Congress, perhaps you want to explain to them what prize authority is and why it's cool and interesting, and perhaps maybe just explain that perhaps there needs to be some tweaks there would be something that we'd like to see happen. Not that I'm advocating that, but we're just educating. Just educating.
I'm happy for other people to educate.
Okay, good.
Okay, so Gabby, this question about why, you know, you're working across sectors. We touched a little bit about what are some of the challenges. Talk a little bit more about what you experience when you work with governments. You talked about one hand not knowing the other, but maybe just a little bit, maybe you could just elaborate a little bit about that, or just any reactions to the conversation.
So in general, I think there's still a lot that needs to be done in order to bring a lot of the discussions that have happened over the years in terms of bringing these partnerships together and making them effective. So I think that we have lots of room for improvement. But when we select partnerships at the Office of Global Social Innovation, I again take existing processes and skills that we already have. I mean, we operate in 170 countries around the world. We have the IT system that allows us to do that. We have the whole processes in place. So I went to the sales guys and said, how do you do the sales account management process? You know, how do you sit together? What does the roadmap look like and so forth? So I took exactly the same template that I take when I sit down with the Clinton Health Access Initiative or Mothers to Mothers or Tostan or you name them, and we go through the process and it shows here's what we want to achieve, here are the milestones, here's how we want to measure whether we have been successful a year from now or not. So I just take stuff that we do anyhow and the knowledge that we have. And sometimes it's a new learning and sometimes it takes time to sort of get to work together, you know, in a very efficient way. But in general, I find that works really, really well. And it's also led to the fact that with some partnerships, they just didn't continue the way they started. You know, we just changed along the way because, again, when we get into these partnerships, we select them because we do think they can scale and they can really help address an issue and potentially even alleviate or make sure that we really get our arms around it. And if we cannot do that, then, you know, we have to also recognize when things don't go so well. But when you have a plan according to milestones, you'll recognize it early on. So I think just taking what we know best anyhow and applying it to this space is something that we can bring, and that's also a great benefit for our partners from the government and from the NGOs, because that's a learning for all of us.
Let's take one more question. The woman over here.
Thank you. It's kind of a follow-on to Gabby, actually. And I'm wondering, how do you stay clear of corruption in this situation? Because your case of Kenya, mm-hmm. where you did good works with good heart, and then it encouraged the Kenyan government to give you contracts for your company, mm-hmm. that's an offset agreement in some ways, isn't it? How do you keep a good line mm-hmm. so everything's above board?
So first of all, let me just clarify, what we had done is we had built out a reference case and it was in no way related to any business whatsoever. That was a pure donation. We just went and we built what had to be built in order to address this issue. And we did that together, again, with the Clinton Health Access Initiative, who had already been in the country, had identified the issue, and together with them, we worked on the solution and what had to be done in order to get our arms around it. What we then did is just use it as a reference case for our country management to say, here are our capabilities. I don't know whether this is going to lead to any future business or not. We are now invited, whereas we have not been before, because the Minister of Health and the department did not know of the capabilities that we have. We'll be one of many parties that will be looking at future deals. And if they think that we are the best partner for them, then we will have a chance for business. Before, we weren't invited to the table to come up with a bid. So now we are. We never do work at all in order to get immediate business. This is really to open doors, build relationships, understand also where are the where do the funding organisms come in, and what are their priorities, and does our solution help there to make sure that there is visibility to what it is that we do. So a lot of it is really is the reputation that you build, the knowledge that you build, because as I said earlier, in not only in the growth markets in general, HP is not known for all of its capabilities, and for us that's really the core to show in a microcosm what we can potentially do and that this works whilst we really address some of these social issues and make sure that the children have a chance to survive. So I have not encountered anything where we had given or made a donation and received something in exchange.
Gabby, Alex, thank you both so much. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you.